Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Before we get going here, I really want to thank the more than 1,200 folks who pledged more than $211,000 to the WILL Radio, here to WILL Radio, during our fall membership campaign. We just finished it up. We also want to welcome 154 of you who became new friends of WILL. Your investment in this station will help us continue to bring you the level of service that you expect from us in the year to come. And if you didn't get a chance to make a contribution, you always can log on to our website for pledging. That's willpledge.org. And again, we want to thank you very much for your support. This morning on Focus 580, we'll be talking with John Palfrey. He's professor of law at Harvard Law School. He's also faculty director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And the Berkman Center is interested in exploring and understanding cyberspace and how it developed, what its dynamics and norms are, and also to think about the possibility that laws and sanctions need to be developed and applied to the way people conduct themselves in cyberspace. We'll be talking this morning about a new book that he has written. The title of his book is Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives, and it's published by Basic Books. And the point that he makes here, kind of the metaphor, is this. And when it comes to the digital world, anyone who was born before, say, about 1980 is an immigrant. But those people who were born after, they are digital natives. Major aspects of their lives now are mediated by digital technologies, and they have never known it any other way. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about the way that these digital natives may well transform the world, and those are some of the themes in the book, Born Digital. Questions, comments from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of folks is that they try and be brief in their comments, but of course, anybody's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments, they are certainly welcome. Professor Palfrey, hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, David. This is great.
Well, you know, I've been trying to think about this, and I am sure that that there are plenty of people who are, again, to take this metaphor, they're digital settlers in the digital world, people who are more than 30 years old, who surf the web, and they may blog, and they may Twitter and send text messages, and they may participate in virtual online communities, and they do all of these kinds of things, and download music, and they have iPods and so forth. But I guess the question here is, though, for those people who do remember what it was like before, and you compare them with younger people who, to extend the metaphor, they haven't just dipped their foot in the pool, they're swimming in the pool. What really is the difference between the way that these two groups experience the world?
So this is a great question, because I think it gets to the overall concept of, are kids really any different in this way? And what does it mean to have had this sort of accident of birth on a certain date or another date? The way we've thought about it is that it's not a generation of kids who are born digital exactly. It's really a population. So we use 1980 as kind of a arbitrary date in some level. It's really when we thought that the social web started. So those young people who were born after 1980 and who have both access to the technology. One important thing is only 1 billion out of the 6.6 billion people on the planet have access. That's an important dividing line. And then most important in the U.S. context in some ways is, do they have the skills to use it? Are they sophisticated in how they do? So there is this population that we're thinking of as digital natives. If you are a digital settler, somebody like me, I was born a little before 1980, and I was there as the social web came online. I was, you know, kind of part of the first group online. I suspect many of your listeners, and you may be in that same category. I think many of us use these technologies very much like the way that digital natives do. There's not that much difference. I think the only difference there between a digital settler and a digital native in this way is that we knew something before, that those of us who are digital settlers probably wore a Walkman on the way to our first job as opposed to an iPod, right? And so mm-hmm. there is some extent to which we have a sense of a world that wasn't this complete hybrid of digital and analog. What that difference means, that's one of the things, of course, we've struggled with in the book. And then this other category that we've been working with in thinking in gross overgeneralized terms, is a group of digital immigrants, people who later in their life have come to use to some extent these technologies. You know them in part by the fact that they're still sending around large mass emails with bad jokes or urban myths. Haven't quite sort of gotten as facile maybe with the use of these technologies as others have, but for whom obviously using some technologies in their work, say, or reaching out to their grandchildren, this is a part of their life, but not a central part. So these are, again, not perfect categories, but thinking about digital natives, digital settlers, and digital immigrants is kind of how we tried to divide up the populations.
Yeah. I wonder if maybe one of the differences is, and it may be important, is the difference between digital natives and digital settlers, is that because digital settlers do have experience of other kinds of technologies, mm-hmm. they knew what came before.
That's right.
Then when it comes to the new technologies, they are maybe more prone to ask questions about them, or to think, well, you know, is this good, bad, or otherwise? Mm-hmm. And that the digital natives, they don't ask those questions. They don't ask themselves, well, is this good or not? It just is. And that may be an issue because every technology does have a downside, and it's worth spending some time thinking about what's good and what's bad about anything.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's just right. So that this is the basic idea, I suppose, of context and a sense of history. I've been struck, you know, on a related matter, listening to the chatter about the financial crisis that we're in today, the global financial crisis, and, you know, the people I listen to and think are most relevant here are people who have seen other things before, right? This is where historians can be very helpful to say, this is how it's like what's happened before, here's how it's unlike. And I think that's something possible for digital settlers and not possible for digital natives. You haven't lived through the equivalent of a world that wasn't so mediated in these ways. And I think to some extent that allows for a perspective that says, actually, you know, this may be an excess. This may be, you know, going too far in this respect. So one way in which this plays out may be a distinction between some digital settlers and some digital immigrants, which is one thing we have found, take privacy. It's one of the issues where we have a fair amount of concern. Mm-hmm. Young people do put a lot more information about themselves online in ways that others can see it and can see it over time. But it's also the case that many adults do the same thing. And I think for digital immigrants, people coming to the space anew and without the same kind of history around it, you know, they often do put too much information about themselves. So often the worst offenders about leaving information about themselves online is not the kids, it's actually adults using dating sites, for instance. Whereas I think somebody who may be a digital settler may have had a little more context for this, has seen both sides of it, and they may be in some ways better prepared than either digital natives or digital immigrants in this regard.
Yeah. The book is divided into a number of sections, and they look in various ways at the various implications of how people use this technology, what it does to them, what it means for the world. And certainly, it seemed that a lot of the concerns do revolve around the fact that there is an increasing amount of information that's collected about us, some of it with our active participation,
right.
Some of it not. And there are very serious questions about how much information there is, how it gets into cyberspace, who has access with it, and do we have any control?
Yeah.
And I think you've touched on one of those things that is a point that's often been made, is that people, particularly young people, when it comes to social networking and in everything else they do, are revealing an awful lot about themselves, putting out a lot of personal information about themselves. And the thing that people are cautioned about is something like, remember that there's the potential that this information is never going to go away.
Right.
And that the idea is that young people aren't thinking carefully enough about whether they, in fact, want to put that out there. And how would you suggest that, particularly if the focus here is parents and their children, that we talk with our children about what it is they do and the information about themselves that they put out there and whether, in fact, they really want to be doing that or not?
It's an incredibly hard problem, actually, because I think it's something we're naturally doing all the time, which is trading convenience for control we are very often willing to leave a fair amount of information about ourselves online in order to get the advantage of a free service. So Google is a really good example. Most of us are very happy to do searches on Google or to use Gmail or work at any of their other services for free because it makes life easier, and you use it on your handheld, you use it online, and so forth. Likewise, young people love Facebook and MySpace and leave a fair amount of information about themselves there and so forth. I think one big issue is that the young people putting the information online, when they start doing it, don't have this sense of persistence, the sense that it will be there for a long time. This is one of the things a colleague of ours, researcher Dana Boyd, writes a lot about, is that young people don't have a sense that they are putting something into a public space that is just like putting it on the front page of the New York Times, which will then be just reprinted every day, in a sense. And you may imagine an audience that is just your friends, just the 10 or 15 people you can think about reading about it, and you think of them reading it right away. You don't think about these unintended audiences, the people who may come to it much, much later, or those who are data brokers, companies that have it as their business to aggregate lots of information about us for the purpose of selling advertising and so forth to us. So I think we don't have the perspective, doesn't matter if you're a young person or old person, to make good decisions day to day in terms of leaving information about ourselves in digital public spaces. So, what can be done about this? Well, obviously the law could be developed further. There's no general protection for personal data under U.S. law anyway. So there are legal approaches. But as we develop in our book, Born Digital, one of the things that we have tried to say is, before you get to passing a law, which is often a blunt instrument in these areas, part because technology changes so fast and usage changes so fast, we should look at what we individually can do. So what can young people themselves do? Well, they certainly can be smarter about leaving less information out there. They certainly peer-to-peer, as they talk to one another, can give guidance to one another. And we found in our interviews and focus groups, young people really listen to one another on these kinds of topics, and they'll often tell stories about what happened to my friend. You've certainly heard that in lots of contexts. There's also, I think, a key role for parents and for teachers. The book that we wrote, Born Digital, is very much directed toward an audience of parents and teachers. Parents and teachers can just give common sense guidance. You know, guys, it doesn't make sense to put that picture of yourself and your friend that has, too little clothing on or drinking beer at age whatever, onto a social network or onto your blog, because that may get discovered later. Very simple things that are just kind of common sense interventions will really help. And then last, we look at technology companies. There's a lot that the technology companies who are, in fact, providing these services can do. Think about privacy controls, making privacy policies, which nobody reads, not young people, not older people, making those much more understandable. So with a complex problem like this, privacy is a really good example. No one intervention, no one passing a law, or no one thing any individual can do can solve this issue. It's got to be a community-oriented solution where lots of people play various different roles.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly a significant problem, and it's something that I'm sure, I think people are becoming increasingly aware of. Certainly, mm-hmm. We've talked about it with other guests. That is the fact that there is a great deal of information that's being collected about us and maintained about us mm-hmm. without our consent, without our involvement, without our knowledge.
That's right.
And that's something that I think the only way you really can deal with that would be with some kind of law or regulation. Do you think, in fact, and now I think the law is a little bit behind the curve here, mm-hmm. Do you think that we're going to be giving more attention to these broad issues of privacy and saying that there's got to be a law that says people have the opportunity to see what mm-hmm. information has been gathered about them, to review it, to correct it if they think it's wrong, or to say to the information gatherers, I do not grant my permission for you to share this information with
right.
other people.
Yeah, I mean, I think what will happen, and it'll be very hard to pull off, but I think what will happen is that we will get to a world where users have more control over information about them, where all of us who are putting information into these digital commons or digital public spaces will be able to say, I'm comfortable with it being shared with these people, but I'm not comfortable with this being shared with others. I think correspondingly, you need to get to a point where you have a right to demand deletion. So this is one thing we're working with in our heads as a possible legal solution would be to say, once you put information into a given site, you know, call it a social network or otherwise, you have a right, like with a credit report, to know what somebody is holding about you and then to demand that they delete it or update it or correct it. Another way to think about the law might be to consider data portability, the ability to take it from one service and move it to another. Why would you care about that? Well, one reason is, let's imagine you put a ton of information about yourself, all your photographs, for instance, into one service, and you use it for a couple of years, then that service goes out of business, right? They no longer are going to support the web servers that are going to put it up there. You may want to take all of those photographs and be able to put them somewhere else online because that's an important part of your identity. Or maybe they have just changed their privacy policy. They've all of a sudden said, we can sell all your stuff to somebody else, whereas you couldn't do that before. Right now, there's no legal mechanism that says, in fact, you have to be able to port the stuff that's about you to another place. It's very tricky to figure out how would you write a law that wouldn't cripple U.S. businesses that would make this happen. It's also very tricky to figure out how could you make something that would be, you know, enforceable and so forth. But on the other hand, I think we have to flip from saying this information is controlled by anyone you give it to in terms of an online service provider, especially with these young people who are putting so much of their identities and their lives into these services over time. Mm-hmm.
Our guest, just to reintroduce for anybody who might have just joined us, is John Palfrey. He's the Henry S. Professor of Law and Vice Dean at Harvard Law School. He's also a faculty director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society there at Harvard Law School. And he's published a great deal on the Internet's relationship to intellectual property, international governance, and democracy. He is the co-author of the book Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives. The book is published by Basic Books. Is out now if you'd like to read it. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, I think you say some interesting things about the nature of identity and how that is changing. And I think that it has always been the case that people, in part, form their own identities in various kinds of ways, and that's something that they have direct control over. Then there's a sense in which our identities are formed by other people and how they see us, what they think of us, what they say about us, maybe in some cases what they write about us. And certainly there has always been gossip and the social milieu that people move in. Certainly there are things beyond our control that have to do with our identity. But it seems that what we are going into now, or we're already into now, is a kind of world in which maybe people have new ways of forging their own identities, but at the same time, all the ways in which other people forge our identity as well, and in ways that are completely beyond our control,
right,
seems to have grown even more, I think maybe even more dramatically than our own ability to create our own identity.
Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely right. So one of the things that's changed over a couple hundred years is the extent to which the social identity shaped by other people and what they say about us, who they are, has become increasingly important. And as young people in particular wrap more and more of their social lives into social networks, again, Facebook, MySpace, Zynga, and so forth, there is a great power in other people, sometimes our friends and sometimes people who are not our friends, in putting information about us into the public space. And, you know, one of the funny things that we found in the interviews and focus groups is that young people don't distinguish much between their online and offline identity. So if you say, you know, how are you shaping your online identity? That doesn't make any sense to them. It's just identity. It's where it's expressed, whether it's, you know, what they put on as clothes to go to school, or, you know, how they act with other people in real space, or, you know, what the picture is that they have about themselves on Facebook. But it's also the case that many people thinking about this say, well, they have multiple identities, right? You have one identity that's your real space identity. You've got another identity that is your Facebook account. Then you've got your MySpace account. Then you've got, you know, if you're really advanced, the Second Life avatar, and you've got your blog and so forth. That's really kind of five identities. But I think that's really to miss the point, which is from the perspective of of an onlooker, somebody trying to figure out who is this person, you can often see all five of those different things. It's not about creating multiple identities. It's actually about creating a series of different ways to convey identity, but then somebody can come back and aggregate it. And all that's to say, at different points, there are many things that other people can do that come to shape who we are. And if the way that somebody tends to find out, okay, do I want to go on a date with this person? Do I want to hire them? If that starts with a Google search, then you've got all of these different sources of information, some that you've contributed, some that others have, that contribute to what that person comes to know. That's a really different place than it was a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah. What do you think about, again, here, I guess this is a question about how the law is or is not addressing issues raised by the digital world, about the potential of digital technologies to be used for harm. Mm-hmm. And certainly there are plenty of examples that we can find of people using this with clear malicious intent to do at least psychological, emotional harm to other kinds of people. And there are, I think there are questions about, well, what sort of possibility for redress is there? And is that something that you think that the law should somehow address?
So the law doesn't help you out all that much in this respect. If somebody says something harmful to you or about you and puts it online, you might have the same old kind of recourse that you would have in real space. So let's imagine they say something about you that's untrue and harmful. And it's published in some fashion online. If you know who that person is, you can sue them for defamation, the same thing that you've been able to do in the past if someone wrote it in the newspaper and so forth, or if they said it in some public forum where it in fact did you some harm. So that tort of defamation still exists. What the law hasn't done, and this is actually a big, much debated thing in cyber law circles, if you do it on a sort of a general public website of some sort. Some of the famous cases involve the early AOL, for instance. If you put something that's defamatory about a third person on AOL, you can't. A lawsuit against AOL will not stick. So there's no obligation on the part of the entity that's providing the web service either to take down the defamatory information be sued for liable in any possible way and made liable for the bad things that third parties post on there. So this is something that has served the web very well in its fast-growing era. It's been very good for web services not to have any liability for what their users put on there in defamation terms. But it's something that for somebody who's harmed by what's said on there, they sort of can't believe. What? I can't tell these people to take this down off of this important web service? And the answer is no, you can't. You can tell them, but they don't have to do it under the law. And so that's one of the things that I think a lot of people have been going back and forth on lately, which is now that the web has grown and it's such an important part of how people come to learn about others, you know, should we rethink that liability? And certainly the people who are kind of purists about the web say, no, that would be terrible. It would squelch innovation. And others, the people who are harmed by it, or perhaps their parents or relatives, you know, think, no, the time is now to hold everybody liable for these things.
Yeah. Parents, for a variety of reasons, I'm sure, worry about their children and their participation in these technologies. And because cases of cyberbullying have gotten a lot of attention, and people are also concerned about the possibility that adult sexual predators will use that as a way to try to find young people to prey on. And for those reasons, I think that some parents are really worried, and they're also worried about what it is their kids will see online, whether it's pornography or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
What is there any way to really answer that question in a broad sense? Because in specific cases, we might say, yes, there has been harm. But whether we can say in a broad sort of a sense that there has been a lot of harm and that parents worry, on what level is it justified?
So, you know, this is one of the hardest things to talk about with parents, and I am a parent. One of the ways that we kind of got into this business of writing the book, my co-author and I were Skesser. We both have two kids, and, you know, we've thought about this very much as not just as law professors writing it or as teachers, but also as parents. Bullying is one area where there is a growth of harm being done to kids online. There's no two ways about it. The data show a growing number of psychological harms to young people happening in online spaces. I don't think there's an overall growth in bullying if you add up, you know, what's happening in the schoolyard plus what's happening online. I think it's just a matter of shifting some of where it's happening. And the effects may be slightly different. Again, you mentioned the note earlier of persistence, that all of a sudden these things are happening in a way that you can see them later. So the harms may be continuing in ways that they don't. The other difference may be that all of a sudden adults can see the bullying. Maybe before, it happened during recess on the schoolyard and out of the sight of any adult. Now it's happening in these online spaces where adults can watch it happen, right? So there's an extent to which it's become an online spectacle too. So in many respects, it may be somewhat different. So what should we do about it? I think this is one area, again, where the nature of what's happening, kids being harmful to other kids, just happening to use the internet as the way to do it, is not that different than kids being harmful to one another as they have been since time immemorial. So I think for parents and teachers, as unsatisfying as this is, there's no technological silver bullet that is going to say cyberbullying will end if only we do this. The point is, we have to figure out what are the things that have worked with bullying in the past and figure out how do they translate to this online environment. Maybe there are some things associated with the online environment that make it different that would, at the margins, we should do. So one is anonymity. Some people say what's the different about the web is that you can be anonymous and harm people. So do we need to have greater ability for people to find out who someone is who's anonymous? There's a huge debate around this topic. Do we need to be more authenticated? Do you need to say, I am this person before you can use one of these social networks? Again, all of these things are big policy debates that are playing out right now. But against the backdrop of, yeah, real harm is happening to kids, and many of the times they're being done by peers, not just by older people that we imagine preying on kids. Mm.
I don't know whether children, as in their relationship with their parents, should expect any right to privacy.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that there should be some. At the same time, I think we think it's important for parents to know what their children are doing, to monitor them in a sense, to try to prevent them from harm. Mm-hmm. And there, I guess, again, we have we want to say, well, how do we exactly draw that line? And how do we know where that line is between what is responsible parenting and what is maybe stifling kids in their personal and private lives and in the way they use these technologies?
Super hard question again, and I think goes to the heart of what does it mean to do parenting, I know, ultimately, with kids who are living lives in these ways. So, I think one important thing that came out of our research is not all kids, of course, are the same, and not at all ages should we have the same strategy. So it's pretty clear that when you have young kids, spending the time with them on the computer is a really good idea, right? So if, I have a 6-year-old boy, and we don't let him go online to random websites on his own, we do it with him. And, if you give him a game or something to play with, you might let him do it for a few minutes by himself if it's confined in an offline way and so forth. But you put it in a public area of the house and so forth. As kids get a little bit older into their, early teens or tweens, they're starting to get cell phones, for instance. And so as more and more things go online and are able to be accessed not just through a personal computer but also through a cell phone or, some other PDA, that's a point at which all of a sudden, even if you are looking over their shoulder as they use the service, you know that they can get to it or other parts of the internet just walking down the street once you've given them a cell phone or, at a public library or school or a friend's house and so forth. So all of a sudden you need to recognize that kids are going to be able to access this information all around them in sort of a converged environment. And I think that's the point at which you need to shift gears a little bit from a monitoring-based strategy where you can see everything to one where you're imparting skills to them and saying, here's the context for some of the things you're going to see. Kids are going to access pornography. Many of them want to access it. Some of them are being presented with it accidentally. No matter what, they're going to see it. And I think that's where kind of good old-fashioned parenting skills of, okay, here's the context for it. It's harmful to women in these ways because exploitative, it's a natural part of sexuality. Whatever the thing is, the message that you wish to convey to your kids, That's a part of the story, and I think that's just as important as kind of monitoring what they're doing. There is a whole class of technologies, of course, that you can use that monitor what kids do from afar. So on your home PC, you can, you know, lots and lots of these services available. Historically, things like NetNanny, big companies like Symantec and Microsoft and others offer versions of it. And I think one thing that a lot of parents are saying is, we're going to put these monitors on your computer. We'll know if you're accessing things, and then we'll have a conversation after it. That might also work in your household. But again, I think where you put in these monitoring devices for the older kids and say, you know, it's not about privacy, it's actually about keeping you safe, you also have to recognize that if they get on another machine elsewhere, of course, they can circumvent this monitoring system. And that's, you know, sort of the reality of what kids told us they do. So none of these approaches is perfect. None works for every different age. But I do think there are a bunch of different strategies that parents and teachers, too, can bring to bear to keep kids somewhat safer online.
We have about maybe 20 minutes in this part of Focus, and we're a little bit past our midpoint. I'd just like to, again, introduce our guest, John Palfrey. He teaches law at Harvard. He's a faculty director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society there at Harvard Law School. And he is the co-author, along with Urs Gasser, who is associate professor of law at the University of St. Gallen, and that's in Switzerland. They're the co-authors of the book Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives. It's published by Basic Books, and I think it is in large part intended to try to be a help, as he suggested, to perhaps teachers and parents who are trying to understand the way that their children and students participate in the digital world. But I think for anyone, it's a very nice summary of issues raised by our increasing use of digital kind of technologies and what that means for everyone. It doesn't matter whether you're whether you were born before 1980 or after 1980. A lot of the issues apply if you're going to be operating in the digital world. So, as I say, it's a good summary of a lot of these issues, so you might want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to pick up on something that you talked about a moment ago, I'm also have been thinking about these various kinds of monitoring technologies that parents can use, mm-hmm. not only to, for example, see what their kids are doing on the internet, but of course we now know there are ways for parents to, when their kids are out of their sight, where they can know where they're going, and maybe to some extent what they're doing. I'm sure that for a lot of parents that would have great appeal to know where they were, what they were doing,
right.
If they were in the car, were they doing the speed limit? You know, right. All kinds of stuff like
right.
that.
All manner of monitoring.
The kinds of things. I think probably with some parents, if you'd say, "Would you like to chip your teenager?" They mm-hmm. would say, "Yeah,
yeah,
of course." Then we'd say, "And can we chip you?" They'd say, "What are you kidding me?"
Yeah.
Of course not. So there, I guess in some sense, whether there's, and it may be an appropriate double standard, I don't know, but other folks might say, well, this is just the thin edge of the wedge. I mean, if we say that it's okay to monitor them that way, then do we get people more used to the idea of someone monitoring your activity?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are lots of ways to think about this. Of course, one is we are in something of a national surveillance state here. There's a law professor at Yale, Jack Balkin, who's been writing about this. There is an extent to which Scott McNeely, the head of a big technology company, who said, you know, privacy is dead, get over it. You know, there's some mm-hmm. extent to which he's right, mm-hmm. the fact that it just doesn't exist in this kind of a society. I'm not ready to give up on having some spaces where people can have privacy and some ways in which we need to try to carve out spaces, times, and so forth where you can do things privately. Obviously, that's an important part of liberty in some respects. When it comes to the home, you know, I guess I think of that really as a private decision for families to say, you know, what do we think is the right way before a kid gets to be 17 or 18 to impart values and to keep one another safe and connected and so forth. I think for my own kids, I'm very unlikely to go the chipping route or the GPS tracking route or the even web tracking route when they get into their older teenage years, in part just because I think it's futile and I think it's not necessarily going to, you know, build the kind of trust I want to have with them. But I totally respect a parent's decision who does, you know, try to do that, and maybe in some families that will work. I guess I'm reluctant, really reluctant, to say, though, privacy is dead across the board, even as the nature of privacy is changing, even as the nature of what a public space is changing. I think we should be increasingly vigilant about saying, how do we carve out those times that are truly private? Because I think people learn and obviously get benefit from that.
We have a caller. Others who are listening are certainly welcome to call with questions, comments here in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have someone here in the neighboring community of St. Joe, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi, I just tuned in. I'm not sure if you've addressed this, but I think that kids now are growing up with a situation where they are, for one thing, subject to having all of their actions put on the web very quickly because all of their friends have cell phones, they all have Facebooks or whatever, and sometimes, kids do stupid things, and next thing you know, it's online, and they can be held accountable for that by the school, or, you have situations where a kid who might be being stupid and might flash themselves at some friends in high school, and it's stupid and vulgar, but they put that online, and all of a sudden it's spread all over. It becomes a legal issue. It just seems like kids need to really be educated to understand that everything that they put online is there forever, and it can be spread, and that they just need to be aware that can have serious effects on their lives.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for raising it in this way. It's absolutely one of the key themes of this book we wrote, Born Digital, which is it's really geared toward parents and teachers to say, to parents, I think one of the jobs for all of us who are parents is to impart to kids a sense that, yes, if you put something about yourself or about one of your friends online, it's likely to be accessible to everyone everywhere and perhaps forever, right? There's an extent to which we use a New York Times rule. If you put it online, would you be comfortable with it being printed on the front page of the New York Times, but then also on newyorktimes.com, in their archive forever? Would you be comfortable with that level of publicness? Because ultimately, even if you use privacy settings well and so forth, there's some risk that that's going to happen. It's not to say don't use privacy settings. You should, and be smart about what you're putting online. But I think the likelihood is that things get copied and shared. And I think it's a responsibility that parents, teachers, young people, their friends, everybody has to kind of make people more aware of the reality of leading social lives, mediated by these technologies. And you're quite right to point to cell phones. In societies around the world, but United States in particular, young people get cell phones at an earlier age. They can access the internet from those cell phones. They can use those cell phones to take pictures. It takes 1 second to upload a picture from your cell phone to an internet site. And those are kind of real-time decisions that you might be making at a party or out and about. And it may be something that has a big impact not just on you, but on your friend whose picture you took and uploaded immediately. So there is sort of a quality of, because there is this connectedness and this speed of ability and the knowledge to use it, that kids have to stop and think sometimes and say, wait, do I really want to upload that to the internet forever?
Yeah, I think it's just it's a hard time for kids to grow up because, they're making big decisions which can have huge effects on their lives and their kids, and they don't think about forever.
Right.
And they're just under a situation where they can potentially be under surveillance most of the time. But thank you.
No, I think it's good. One of the other kind of analogies we draw is to tattoos. I think a lot of kids are going to have tattoos a decade from now that they want to get rid of in the form of things that are online about them, right? Somebody will Google their name and they'll find these things that kids don't want and a future employer to see. But it will have been, just a day-to-day decision, maybe even easier than getting your body marked up. But it's going to be just as hard to remove in some ways.
Yeah, I wonder if we're just, if we truly, the only fallback position we have is to say to them, imagine yourself in that situation. You've
right.
done this. You've got this piece of embarrassing thing about your friend, and
right.
you're gonna circulate it. Before you push that button, think about this. What if that was you? I mean,
yep.
what if that you were the one that was in, you know, had the picture with your pants down, and one of your buddies was about to upload this? Would you really want them to do that? And I don't know if that's the kind of thing that, you know, parents have been doing that forever.
Mm-hmm.
They've been sitting down with their kids and saying, now, how would you feel if,
right.
you know, trying to get the child to be in the position of the other person? And I don't know how well that's ever worked, but I wonder if that, in fact, is the only thing that we truly can fall back
on. It's pretty close to the only thing. And I agree that it's those kinds of strategies that we've used before that we have to, you know, evaluate and try here. One thing I'll say on the more positive side, we did interviews and focus groups primarily to get our data from this, in addition to reading the great work that others have done, researchers on this topic. And one thing is, the kids who have spent the most time online and who have spent kind of years in these environments, these kids are more sophisticated, and often much more sophisticated than adults, about not sharing information about themselves. So I'm not that worried about people once they have, you know, they all have a story about what happened to their friend, right? Right. There's some extent to which, over time, kids do get smarter because they listen to one another and they see bad things happening to their friends. Doesn't mean they don't still make mistakes, but I think there's a growing sophistication. The people I'm concerned about are often the kids who don't have such good support networks, the kids who are already at risk, the kids who are not being supported by their parents or their teachers, and those who fall on the other side of what some researchers call the participation gap. These are kids who do have access to the technologies, whether it's in public spaces or at home, but they don't have the support structure to make good decisions. There are two scholars, one Esther Hargitay, another Henry Jenkins here at MIT. These guys have both focused on this notion that what we need to worry about is not so much the most sophisticated kids in our lexicon, the digital natives, but those who are on the other side of the participation gap.
All right, let's talk with someone else on a cell phone here. This is line two. Hello.
Oh, hello. Yes, you mentioned defamation and defamation proceedings. Now, one of the things that's happened, not every country has defamation laws like ours,
uh-huh.
Particularly Britain and, you know, the former Commonwealth countries have a very different form of defamation law.
That's true.
And because the Internet's international, this is being applied in the U.S. more and more. And because the U.S. is the Internet's international, there's some concern that this might happen. I'm particularly sensitive to that because I lived in New Zealand for 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen what that can do to public discourse. I just wondered if you'd like to comment on that.
Yeah, very much so. It's a great question. You know, one just kind of basic statement is the Internet does push globalization further and faster. Of course, it's a joining of cultures along a common platform, and the Internet really is a global network of networks. So anything that happens in the United States could have an impact in, you know, 200-plus countries around the world immediately. So the most famous case of this variety is called Dow Jones versus Gutnick, and it takes place in Australia. The basic idea was that the Barron's newspaper, owned by the Dow Jones Company, published a report very critical of an Australian businessman named Gutnick. And the argument basically was, should it be tried under U.S. defamation laws, which have a greater protection for the speaker and for the newspaper, or should it be tried under the Australian rules, which are more protective of the person who alleges that they were harmed? It turned out that the Australian court asserted jurisdiction over it and managed to bring it under Australian law. And many people made the argument then, well, what will happen is a race to the bottom, that if somebody's harmed by something said on the Internet, they'll just find the place in the world to sue where the law is most favorable to them, and they will haul these, you know, U.S.-based companies across the world to defend themselves. What's interesting is that hasn't yet happened. It's still a fear, of course, and something we'll have to keep puzzling over. But it turns out, I guess, for reasons of convenience, that we haven't seen huge impact of that sort. I still look for these cases because I think it's a really interesting point of, you know, where laws conflict with one another, you know, which law will end up applying. And, you know, there's obviously lots of issues around fairness as well as around the chilling of speech that may come into play here. But it's a great great question and a great topic.
We're so short on time, I hope the last caller won't mind if I go and try to get one more here. Calling from our area here in Champaign-Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Can you comment on so-called Real ID and some places that rent things like movies ask for two IDs, one from column A and one from column B? What's wrong with that first one, which is usually a state ID anyways? It should be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So is the question ultimately about needing multiple forms of ID to do anything?
I guess that sounds like to me that was the question, yes.
Mm-hmm. I think the big question here for the net is we have allowed people to be somewhat more anonymous in the online space than we have in physical space, in the sense that you can go on, get a screen name, and you can carry out your activities without people knowing who you are in a lot of cases. Now, it's almost always the case that if law enforcement wants to figure out who you are and they have enough resources to it, they can track you down. But the point is, if everybody's doing it, it's very hard to track everyone down. I think a fear is, as we get to an internet where people do have to show more ID effectively, there's more identity authentication on the net, are we going to flip it the other way, where in fact it's less private, it's less anonymous, it's in fact more authenticated than it ever was before, because you can trace all the steps that you have. This is one of the big tensions on the internet, is are we going to swing a pendulum from a space that allows somewhat greater anonymity to a space in which the identity authentication is much greater than it ever was before.
All right. Well, again, I hope that gets to the question. We have about 5 minutes left. You know, there's an area we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but at least I want to touch on it as we finish up. And again, it goes back to concerns that parents have about their digital native children, and that is what it is that use of these technologies and the way children use them, and maybe now relates the way everybody uses them, what it does to their brains, what it does to the way that they think, the fact that there's an awful lot of multitasking going on, and some would say fragmenting of consciousness, and there's concern about, you know, whether people are, because of the way we jump from one thing to another, will have the tolerance for the ability for it to follow some kind of complex and extended argument or complex and extended narrative, whether it is actually changing us at that kind of fundamental level. Is there any reason to think that in fact that's actually going on?
I think the short answer is we don't have enough data to make a strong argument around that, but there's certainly a lot of debate about it. There's a book out there called The Dumbest Generation that came out just before our book. I happen to disagree with its premise, but it raises some provocative questions. I've got a colleague here, Harry Lewis, who used to be the dean of Harvard College, who's very concerned about the extent to which young people are less likely to read a book cover to cover, and what that will do for society and discourse and, frankly, the brains of young people. I come at it from a slightly different angle, in part because I'm sort of a glass half full guy, and I believe also in some of the really interesting creative things that young people are doing online, whether that's taking an argument and remixing it, remaking it in their own voice, the kinds of things they're doing in creating profiles and interacting with one another online, even in social networks as creative acts, new art forms emerging and so forth. I also think that young people are doing very interesting things with how they access information and how they can be very sophisticated about taking multiple sources and triangulating. Maybe they don't read sustained arguments like books as frequently, but it's not the case that they interact with information less, is my argument around it. But it's something that I think goes right to the core of our democracy and what kind of a society we have. Are we going to be vigilant about saying not everything that young people are doing digitally is good? Reading books cover to cover has value, and you know, sometimes teachers, I think, have to curb the excesses of young people and how they use information and give them skills affirmatively. What I worry about, though, is that we've got a gap between teachers who feel out of the loop and that they don't get what's going on, and young people who just persist in their activities regardless of whether it's good or bad, and you don't get the kind of conversation. What does it mean to be literate in a digital age? What does it mean to access certain kinds of information, to triangulate, to learn about different sources? Those are the kinds of conversations we have to figure out how to work into the curriculum. And I think for parents and teachers, the message is just get in the game, even though you're not always going to know what the latest technology is or how young people are going to use it. You do have to get your hands dirty. You do have to ask young people to show you the way and so forth. And I think that's a really good place for us to start. Whether or not we think society is going to hell in a handbasket because kids are reading fewer books, we do have to engage with the way in which young people are learning and help to shape that affirmatively. And in some ways, that's sort of the call to arms, you know, at the core of our book, Born Digital.
Yeah, and I think that that's a, I think it's an important, both important point and question, this matter of do we need to teach a new kind of literacy? Is literacy in a digital age, has it changed? Are the demands different? Should that be somehow part of the curriculum? And I think that some, there may be, I suspect some people might say, well, it's the, you know, the proverbial horse is out of the barn. It's too late for us to start doing that. And other people would say, no, it's not too late because providing that you start young, I suppose, or maybe that really doesn't matter. It's the kind of conversation that we should be having. Don't just take for granted that they are, this technology is so much a part of their lives that there's really no point in talking to them about how they're using it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think the horse is partly out of the barn, but I think change is happening so quickly right now in terms of both the technologies and how young people use them that this is just a great time for intervention around these issues. It's a great time for parents and teachers to be playing the role that they have traditionally around literacy and just recognizing, yes, some of what they're doing is in the digital realm. And if we're not affirmatively looking at digital literacy as well as traditional and seeing them, frankly, as no different, they're really converged, you know, then we're missing a huge opportunity.
Yeah. And certainly because this technology and its implications, because the technology continues to change, the implications continue to change. This is not the kind of thing where you're ever going to write the definitive book.
That's right.
At least, you know, not now, maybe someday, but I kind of doubt it.
No, I don't think so. I think our book is obsolete already.
Well, that's, and you actually, that's something you actually address in the book, and say, I think you and your co-author are essentially saying to each other and to the readers, this is your, what you're trying to do is start a conversation. It's a continuing conversation, and that there will not be any point where we can say, well, we're done, we've solved that one, and we'll be going on to the next thing.
That's right, and I know now, David, that you are not a digital native who doesn't read books cover to cover, because that's in the very last chapter of the book, and absolutely one of the ways we left it was recognizing that when we publish the book in the beginning of September and the, you know, hard copy hits the bookstore shelves, that it's going to be somewhat obsolete, that it's one intervention, it's one set of descriptions of something that is moving fast. And so we've created a couple of web presences, digitalnative.org, which has a wiki on it with versions of the book on there. We've got video adaptations done by students. We've got a blog and so forth. We very much want this to be something that changes over time and something that does participate or enables us to participate in ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. And as much as I don't like arguments about generations being dumber than others, I think we do have to be engaged with that conversation and engage with parents and teachers about it on an ongoing basis.
Well, if you'd like to get a snapshot about where we are at this moment, look at the book Born Digital, Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives. The book is published by Basic Books, co-authored by our guest, John Palfrey. He is the Henry S. Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. He's also faculty director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And they do have a website if you're interested in Berkman and what they're all about. You can check that out. And Professor Palfrey, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, David. Take care.